Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Brad.
Yes.
Do you know how we fund the program Going Off Track?
I know exactly how we fund it. There's one source of income for us, and that is patreon.com/goingofftrack, where our loving patrons give us money and we give them bonuses.
Patreon? Stop making up words. It's a great place. We do a weekly Thursday night fireside chat. Brad takes all the embarrassing things I say in podcasts that he doesn't put into podcasts and puts it on the Patreon. Funny pictures of Brad in the 90s, usually naked or wearing a wristband. Please sign up. Brad, what's the address?
Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
You know what I saw today? I saw an Instagram clip of a really, really nice sounding hardcore band playing a show in Highland Park, New Jersey. I just felt so good about it. I was like,
like
music. Like, I love, you know, because we talk about this a lot and Going Off Track. Like, I make the attempt to not be the self-righteous old man, you know, like it's not that good music doesn't exist anymore. It's that I'm 40 and I have kids and the whole cool thing I used to do when I was a teenager and my early, like, it's not there for me anymore.
Right.
And it's there for someone else.
Yeah.
So I hate when I hear these old people going like, oh, that's not like it. I'm like, yeah, it's like it used to be, fucking old shit. Like, it's just not like the thing you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I was really happy to see this, like, great, like, the band sounded awesome. It was a killer breakdown, this cool looking room. Right in Highland Park.
Wow.
Like, you know what? Makes me feel good.
Cool.
And there's a lot of Jersey references in this interview, isn't there?
As one might expect, there is a lot of Jersey references. Another Jersey reference, which I didn't make during the podcast, but it was funny because my story about the mastering, like, old.
Yes.
We were working at Sony Records, and I went in, and they were doing all the Frank Sinatra back catalog for a box set.
Cool.
So I thought that would have made a funny anecdote, considering that you like to think that I'm 40 years older than I really am.
But, yeah, well, I mean, listen, you're in your early 90s. You look great.
But I was excited about that, though.
That's amazing. I mean, well, the cool thing about that is, like, the same as the James Brown thing, which is, like, I mean, these people got the most accomplished musicians in the world to play with them. So when you're taking these masters and you're isolating these tracks, I can imagine you heard amazing stuff.
So they were just, they just had the two-track masters. And I think, in fact, I asked him about that, and he said, you know, the only isolation they had was, like, band and vocal, which, I mean, that would be pretty cool too. Because, like, he said that a lot of that early Frank stuff was done on, like, three track machines. That was, like, the format.
And just these, like, pro players coming in, just doing the backing stuff together.
Being in, like that mastering environment with those speakers where you can hear everything anyway. It's like, it's the same kind of, it's almost better really than isolating stuff because you can hear into the mix, you know?
Yeah. I remember I got to, when we recorded a record at Blackbird Studios down in Nashville,
right?
They have one room there. I mean, all the rooms are gorgeous, but they have one room there that's known to be like just this acoustic powerhouse, you know, like designed in this, like, really unique way. The speakers, like, you know, behind you, to the side of you, to the front of you, this, like, full surround sound environment.
Oh, is there probably their surround mastering room? That would
be.
That would
and
be
then
intense.
And then they played Pink Floyd on there.
Right.
Like, you know, like we all got a little crispy, went in that room and listened to Money.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, there's a guitar to my left. Whoa, there's a cash register behind me. You know, like all this crazy shit. And it's really amazing once you start putting that stuff together.
Oh, I love that stuff, man.
Yeah, well, you would. I'm sure that's the nerdiest shit ever. Perfect for you. But Mikey was so kind to give us this time. As I talked about in the interview, I'd felt awful because I've known Mikey for ages. He's such an accomplished musician himself. But all I was hitting him up for was other people's mysteries.
Right.
You know, I'd done it like 4 times. And then we got to that Chris Gethard interview. And I was like, fuck. I need Mikey again, you know, like he's my, you know, my path here. I'd asked my friend Kevin. He kind of only gave me anecdotal stuff. And I was like, I got to go to Mikey again. And he never hit me back.
Right.
And I was terrified that Mikey was mad.
He'd had enough.
You know? I was like, oh my God. He's like, no more mystery friend. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride, you know? I was like, fuck, I got to make this up. So I'm glad we got to do this.
And, so welcome to the mystery friend episode.
Yeah, there's a good like 30 minutes of great. But I mean, these are great tales.
Yes, of course. Absolutely.
Great tales. Yeah. Great tales.
It's fully worth it. I mean, if we had the time, we could just do the whole podcast of getting mystery friends, you know, with the right person.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, I had more for Mikey. I know a lot of his crew. Well, we'll just do another one. But yeah, man, he's such a great player, such a great songwriter, as we talked about at the end, just like so immersed at all times in what he's doing that I just think like the sky's still the limit for Mikey. I feel like someone with like just such a vast knowledge and experiential database that he has with music that he'll just be able to keep doing this forever and keep being able to be curious and get weird and write great songs. And I don't know. I'm just really excited to see where he goes from here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And a fine human. but I'm still the one thing that's hard for me to buy in this interview, and I not to say Mikey would mislead me in any way, is I have such a hard time believing as a drummer you can listen to another drummer play drums on your song and not have an idea, you know, not just be like, fuck, that fill would be perfect.
Oh, no.
It's gotta be hard to let go.
Absolutely. I have ideas and I'm not a drummer, you know?
Right, right. And you don't know how to say them. You're like, can you maybe go which is what every guitar player says. You could be talking about a blast beat or like syncopated jazz, and the guitar player will be like, can you just go?
Yeah, come on.
What fucking noises are you even making?
You should just hear it from the guitar part, man. Can't you hear my rhythm guitar? I'm playing the drum part right here. You can't fucking get that?
You fucking people. You fucking people in your soundscapes. Get out of here. But anyway, let's get into this interview with Mikey, because it was... is 90 minutes of pleasure, and who wants to listen to me anymore, you know? It's going off track! Mikey, let me see if you know the answer to this, because I just found this out.
Uh-huh.
It's cool. What American city are the original manuscripts of Lord of the Rings? Where do they live?
You know, I feel like I knew this at some point. I feel like I've seen them.
Ooh,
really?
I haven't seen them.
I feel like I was at the place where they are, but I don't remember. But I'm gonna feel very stupid in 2 seconds when you tell me.
Well, the city is Algonquin for the good land.
Milwaukee.
Yeah, they're in Milwaukee, but I think it's because Marquette University was like a Jesuit college, and he was a Jesuit and had some kind of like connection to the school.
Huh.
And that's how they went up there.
He was a Jesuit? Yeah. Wow.
I believe so.
Interesting.
And in my recent research, are Jesuits like the coolest of the Christians? It seems like it.
Good question. I don't know if any of them are cool.
I mean, the coolest. Well, I like their idea of like figuring out problems. What is that called? Yeah. Casuistry or something, you know? Like,
you know,
it's interesting. It's a little more functional than like, ah, the devil is going to slap you with his dick, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, that's Christian. That's normal Christian lore.
That's so Christian.
Seems more use. That is in it, right? Yeah. Listen, I'm an Old Testament guy. You know that. Horowitz, you know?
And then the devil strucketh Judah with his peni.
Brad, I forget that you, because of your father and stuff, you probably have some weird biblical
My dad taught at a Jesuit college at Holy Cross in Worcester.
Oh.
They didn't treat him too well.
Can you give me some insight then about the Jesuits being the coolest of the Christians?
No, they weren't cool to him, so.
Oh.
But, you know, he was kind of.
So maybe it's all bullshit.
Yeah, I guess not. I guess none of them are cool. You're right, Mikey. So what's going on?
Not much. Just
where are you?
I'm at home.
Nice.
On the old couch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And how is it for the busiest man in show business to...
It's crazy to be getting busy again.
Yeah.
Once word got out, I got vaccinated. I've had work again.
The calls started coming in.
Yep.
The Mikey phone.
Yep.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Well, what was it? You know, like, what was your initial shutdown like and stuff? Were you going out? Were you trying to push a new record? Like, what kind of touring and stuff like that did you have to stop?
Warriors had just finished a record, and it came out the night that we started our tour with Brian Fallon.
Oh,
I don't know if you've ever heard it.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard this guy. He's pretty good songwriter.
I literally just got off the phone to start this. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, and he says hi. I actually said, I have 6 minutes to get on with Mikey. And he said, tell Mikey I said hi.
Awesome. Hello to Brian Fallon. But yeah, so we the record literally came out that Friday. We played one show and then popped back home for 15 months or whatever it was.
Yeah, just a little 15 months.
Yeah, and you know, right at the beginning, I was like, fucking cool, a couple week break finally. This is awesome.
Right.
You know, thinking that it was not going to last that long. And then here we are.
I remember at one point, I think it was like maybe like 3 or 4 months into it where I was like, oh wow, this is now officially the longest I haven't played a show.
Yeah.
Since I was like 12. What was yours?
That was the thing. Yeah. It was, I was realizing that since, you know, I kind of consider my professional career, quote unquote, starting on the first Dirt Bike Annie tour I ever went on, which was in the year 2000. So
okay,
certainly within 20 years, in 20 years, that was the longest I'd ever gone without playing.
Yeah.
I can't imagine I ever went more than a couple weeks without playing a show or seeing a show.
Did you like, in that time, did you, or do you feel, because of that window you had, that you were able to learn something about yourself, see something about yourself that you kind of hadn't been able to grab because of the constant movement?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly feel like I got to, just like on a personal note, I got to kind of check out my mental health situation. That was something that I never really had. I always either just pushed it away or didn't have time to deal with it.
Mm.
And so that was cool. That was a cool thing to be able to to address.
I mean, was that like an individual performance, or did you start doing, you know, getting into therapy and stuff like that?
I finally got to go to a doctor and see, yeah, and, you know, get some medication. Yeah. And that's been an eye opener. I had lot more time to actually, you know, I was super busy making solo music and writing solo records and, you know, getting that aspect of, you know, which was always on the back burner for me just because I was always going, doing other things. And like, I don't really write on the road. So if I was on the road with Warriors or something, like I never really took the time to sit with a guitar and write songs.
Is that because you're in like drum mode with Warriors or you're just not a tour writer?
I'm just, I kind of just need to have my own space and like, you know, just to be kind of alone with my, you know, thoughts and like a guitar to write songs. So actually it was interesting. The last few months, like, you know, my wife's been working from home. So I would just like take my like little backpacker guitar to the park and just write songs there that way. And that actually was better because it actually gave me, I was going somewhere to do something. It was almost like going to a job, you know, like,
right.
And I had no other choice but to sit and write this song that I came to write, you know, and that actually became, I became pretty prolific that way.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wait, so was 2016, that was your first solo record? Like official?
The first official album, solo album.
Yeah. So like, you know, just from someone who's watched a lot of your career and, you know, the fact that you were known as the front person of the Ergs, of the Ergs. Like, was there some kind of, like, was it like a punk rock guilt? Was there some kind of scruple for you to like head out solo that it took a while to get over?
No, I mean, it really was just like when the Ergs broke up, I really felt I needed a break from being the creative, being the songwriter. Right. In the band, I just felt I was kind of sick of it. It's weird to think back on it and realize like maybe this wasn't the actual perception, but I perceived like the last Ergs record that, you know, it didn't do as well as we thought it was going to do from what I could, you know, from my perspective. And I was like, you know, there's a bit of like, well, am I even good at this anymore? Have I already written all my good songs? You know, like, and, whenever pretty shortly after the Ergs, I was starting to get asked to play solo shows.
Right.
And, so I would just play Erg songs. And then every once in a while I'd come up with like a song or a single or something and I would do that. But I just never felt, I would write songs and I would kind of just throw them away because I didn't think they were good or whatever. But, I just never had the impetus to just sit down and make a record or collect more than just a couple songs at a time.
Of course you don't have imposter syndrome as a player, but do you think you were having it like as a front person, like a singer-songwriter? Is it just like a hard label to put on yourself?
I was just talking to someone the other day about how like that was another thing that I took that this year kind of, I embraced myself as a singer-songwriter, like actually not feeling weird about calling myself that.
Right.
I guess like the fact that like, I just recorded what will be my fourth record. It's like, okay, well, yes. I've actually done this a few times now and
you're not a rookie.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I can call myself a songwriter now.
Yeah. You're on your second pro contract. Now.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's something that popped into my head the last few months of like, okay, I think I'm doing this, I guess.
Do you think it maybe took like a couple albums to even, Was it a matter of sort of finding your own singular voice before you were willing to kind of call yourself that?
Yeah, it felt natural even like making the first record. It just, and like I made it with Jeff Rosenstock. He's such an easy person to like make a record with.
Yeah, he's so vibey.
Yeah, and like, and he just had, so many good ideas. We got it done really quickly and it was super easy. The people I chose to play on it just knew their shit and we got it done really quickly. And, you know, so it was really easy, but then I made the second solo record, like just me and my friend Alex. And that was super easy, but that was really just the two of us vibing in like a rehearsal space. I like the idea of every, like the thing I like about the solo projects is I'm kind of actively making each one kind of completely differently.
Oh, cool.
And completely different, like in completely different environments, completely different people working on the records.
And that's intentional.
And that's intentional because I don't want to make the same album twice.
Right.
Like the only thing close to that is the last record we made, or the, you know, I just recorded a record in Chicago with Steve Albini, and that's the same, essentially the same lineup that recorded the first album.
Oh, okay.
But
so you brought it back.
Yeah, but it still sounds fairly different than the first album.
How hard is it to be your drummer?
Not hard at all. I don't
think. Not hard.
I mean, because
you're not a dick about it?
I'm not a dick about it at all. In fact, like I almost purposely don't even think about how I want the drums to sound on something.
Oh, just got to take yourself out of it completely.
And like, because honestly, that's kind of, as someone who plays drums in most bands that I'm in.
Yeah.
It's the hardest thing for me to come up with something, or at least for another songwriter to come up with what I think they want in their head. I'm usually never there with them in terms
of
like, it's got to be explained to me. So I kind of purposely don't want them to know what I think the song is going to be.
Huh.
Cause I want to be surprised, and I want like for a couple of the songs on this record I just made, like, I sent Lou demos and she sent back like, you know, just her playing over my demo. And it was like a drum part that I absolutely wouldn't have thought to put there.
Right.
Like it was
more
of like maybe a vibey thing where I would have done more of a straight thing.
Yes.
And it made the song better. You know, like that's the most fun about making records with other people to me is figuring out what they're going to, or listening and being surprised at what they're playing. And you know, even if it's something that I'm not super into at the moment, I'll kind of live with the demo for a little bit or something. And then if I really decide I don't like it, I don't like it. But pretty much everything that Lou played on this last batch of stuff, like even if it was something that at first I was like, oh, I don't know about that, it was always something I made sure that was stayed on the record because I thought it was great, you know?
That's interesting. You know, I've had a tough... Not tough. I mean, I don't make it sound like woe is me, but it's been a challenge at times in the modern age of songwriting.
Yeah.
When, you know, instead of when I used to get like an acoustic demo from someone I wrote songs with, or, you know, oh, check out this riff.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Now you get like, you know, something from a computer.
Yeah.
With either like a, you know, a digital track behind it, one of the, you know, just whatever, custom throw in their tracks or something they tried to write. And I often do find it frustrating because I get demoitis so easily.
Totally.
That if I listen to more than like two or three times, I have a hard time getting out of there. But I have listened back to a couple records where I'm like, you know what? Like, I would never wrote that part. It's like not my style.
Right. Yeah.
And you get so locked into your own style sometimes and what you expect to hear that you can kind of get boring, right?
Yeah, like, absolutely. And I feel like, I feel like I am, I feel like I do kind of default to like, I don't know, like the boring part, I guess. Like, I don't know why, like it's not usually the first thing that comes to my head isn't normally like a weird, like off time pattern, you know, whatever drum pattern thing. Like for the last Warriors record that we made, that was pretty much the demos I was getting from Lauren had what they were thinking in their minds for the drums.
Okay.
And like, I think Lauren is a lot more influenced by some of the more like indie rock drummers, like, and it's like stuff that that's not my first influence. So I'm not taking that like, so it was actually super fun to like, to learn these parts that I actually had to work on getting the timing of and everything, because I would not have thought, it wasn't my first inkling to play, you know? So that was pretty much how we made the whole last Warriors record was Lauren actually like finally got the equipment and all the stuff to like, to really be able to explain to me what they were hearing in their head.
She's in LA now. She needs the stuff.
Yeah.
Gotta have the stuff.
But yeah, and it was cool because that was a thing for like the record before that was there were a couple songs that they didn't really know what to tell me. And I was like, oh, this is what I'm hearing. And
yeah,
it was like, right. Oh, well, that's like too much of like a pop beat. I'm thinking more of a, right. You know, like we would have like weird little stalemates like that that we, you know, we got through and figured something out. But like there was a bit of a challenge just like figuring out what the songwriter was hearing in their head.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like,
I guess we got to work with Skynet a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
can't just totally go John Henry.
But yeah, I guess like, cause I'm so influenced by A, Ringo, and B, right. Pop punk. So like my thing is like, don't get in the way of the song. Mm-hmm. Like you shouldn't even notice that I'm there. You know? Like,
right.
I should just be driving the thing. All I want to do is keep the fucking thing on time. That's all I want to do.
Well, I could see that being a weird battle as a singer and a drummer, because so often a singer is demanding that you just service the song.
Right.
You know, like do what makes the song best.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then so it's almost like you got these two little guys on your shoulders.
Exactly.
Maybe, you know?
And you don't really know which one to go with for this particular song.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funky.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned it before. We got to talk about Albini.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, come on, that's crazy. So how did that come about?
It was just, you know, I'm kind of in the mode of making all of my dreams come true while I can.
awesome.
That's one of the dreams that I've had since I was a very young kid. So I, Joe Steinhardt had worked with him numerous times.
Oh, okay.
Like, he'd done a couple, they'd already, you know, Don Giovanni had already put out a couple records from there. There was Joe did like a talk at Drexel, with Steve Albini, like as like the guest. So like, they knew they have a text relationship at this point,
cool.
I believe. Yeah. So, you know, I kind of was just like, how realistic would it be for me to do a record with Steve Albini? He's like, I'll text him right now. He just like,
look at you, Joe.
Yeah, it was pretty great. And we just booked it for like, you know, a month we booked it for like a year later.
Okay.
Thinking that I'll, you know, and then in the interim, I made this Mike Yerg self-titled record that I didn't even plan on making. I just did it because I just wanted to play with Fid and Chris a bit. Fid and Chris Pierce, who we had the right before lockdown, we had done a tour together, and it was really fun. And you know, I liked the way it sounded. I was like, I want to get this lineup on tape. So then I quickly wrote like 10 songs and went down to Volume 4, Pierce's studio, and we just bashed the fucking record out in a day. And so I didn't even plan on making that record. And then I'd already been writing for this record. And so then once that was done, I finished this record, and then we went to Albini and recorded that. And it was one of the best experiences ever. It was,
fuck yeah.
It's exactly what you would think it was, you know, like everything just sounded good immediately. He just knows, he knows what the fuck he's doing. There's no fucking around.
Did you guys do much pre-production on it?
No, nothing. Like he doesn't want demos. He doesn't want anything.
Oh,
he doesn't.
Cool. Wow.
He's just like, just come in and know your shit.
Wow.
And
that's cool.
Luckily I was kind of like, oh, we'll go in there. We'll knock it out. It'd be great. And Jeff was like, book a day of rehearsal the day before. And I was like,
right.
If you think we need it, thank God we did it, because we spent like we spent like 9 hours just like really, really hammering the songs down. And then we got we got the album done in like a day and a half, you know, basic tracks. So like it worked, and I'm glad we did it. But I was totally like, we don't need to rehearse. Come on.
Yeah.
We're professionals.
So what's a classic Albini type situation that happened in there? Was there like a part of the process where you were just like, oh, okay, that's why he like just makes great records?
Yeah. I mean, he has a way of, you know, so we walked in, we set our gear up, and then he said, okay, go fuck off for an hour. Those were the exact words.
Exact words.
Go fuck off for an hour. I'm gonna mic up the stuff and align the tape machine.
Okay.
And then we'll do a sound check. He calls it a sound check. I've never heard it called a sound check in the studio.
Yeah. Nope.
And it really is akin to a show. It's just like I played my guitar. He hit the talk back. He said, that was easy. Okay, Jeff, plug your shit in.
Wow.
Jeff plugged his shit in. He got the right volumes, you know, and then for everybody else, we did that. We recorded one song and I was like, there it is. There's your sound. It's right there. I don't think we need to change anything. I think we may have changed like the bass tone or something, but other than that, yeah.
How long has he been in that room?
In that space, I think 96 they moved in.
Oh, okay. So just one of those rooms that he knows every inch of.
Yes. Yeah. He just knows exactly what, and that's, it was funny. We were having a conversation on the way down. Me, Lou, and Alex had driven out to Chicago. And I was like, I think we'll have the record done in a day. And Alex was like, there's no fuck. He's like, it's going to take so much time to get sounds. And I was like, I think Albini knows what that room sounds like. I bet we'll have sounds in 5 minutes. And we pretty much had sounds in like, you know, it was probably like 20 minutes of actually trying a couple different things out to get sounds. But like, it was not difficult at all.
That's awesome.
And you immediately hear the first playback and you're like, that is there. That's right. That's that sound. That's it. There it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's an easy guy to be around in the studio and stuff.
Yeah. He's really funny. And, you know, we'll have like little aside conversations about like just bullshit, like anything, like, you know, the founder of Vans died the night before. And we were talking about like how great Van's shoes were for like a 10 minute, you know, it's just like, and he knows everything about everything. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, there's not one subject you could stump him on where he didn't know the exact answer of, you know, we were talking about like just memes and I don't know. It was awesome. It was very fun to hang out with him. But then, you know, once we got to work and we didn't bullshit.
Was there like a question that you came with in your pocket, like just something you had to know?
No, in fact, we were pretty conscious of and certainly at rehearsal and all this other stuff. We were like, let's get all the fucking stupid, like talking about Nirvana out of the way now. So we would kind of make it so that it would organically come up somehow. Like he would bring up, he'd be like, yeah. And then when I did the Nirvana record, we used this compression.
Oh, okay. So he like, tosses it in there.
Yeah. Cause we'd be talking about like, oh, that's crazy. Use like such this weird compression ratio on the vocal. Like I've never seen that before, you know, whatever. Right. And he's like, oh, that's what we did when In Utero, you know, like we would, it would come up every once in a while. There was one day where we were driving to the studio and Alex is like, I'm just going to get him to say Pixies once. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to get him to say the Pixies. And then at some point he said the Pixies because he was talking about like making that record or whatever.
That's awesome.
So we were trying to not be complete idiot fanboys, but also we were trying to be complete idiot fanboys.
Sure. Yeah. Hard not to.
Because why waste that opportunity?
So when can we expect the record?
It's looking like, you know, that everything is so backed up. We're getting it mastered next month, and then I think we'll be lucky if it comes out a year after that.
Wow. Is it just from pressing?
Yeah. I've heard that even the jacket company, the place that prints the jackets, They're backed up like 10 months.
Whoa.
And then the pressing plants are backed up like a year to 13 months.
Wow. I knew it was bad. I didn't know it was that bad.
It's way worse than I thought it was.
With that in mind, are you thinking like eyeing some kind of digital content or something?
I don't know. Like I've talked to Joe about it and he's like, you did literally just release a record like 3 months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like,
that's true.
Yeah, you're right. I can probably tour that one for a little while. And then, you know, it's actually nice to not have to already have the next album in the can.
Right.
And to not, yeah. not even have to think about it.
Yeah. Have you ever went on a tour not having to think about what you're doing next?
Yeah, no.
It's kind of freeing.
Yeah. It's actually, yeah, it's kind of, it's the one, like, you know, silver lining of the whole thing is, like, you know, I of course, like every artist ever in the history of recorded sound, think that the album, the new album, is the best one I've ever done, and I want everybody to hear it. But you know, hey, it can wait. It doesn't have to come out right now.
I mean, you can also, like, just keep the Mikey Erick thing going. Just do another one.
Yeah,
in six,
I mean,
months.
That's what I was thinking. You know? Like, I could do like a fucking an EP or something in between, yeah. and you know, just fucking yeah. Because I think I have a couple like tours that. You know, were supposed to happen 2 years ago. They're now going to happen that I might want a new record for, but
right.
I also just made a new record, so I can just tour that for a little while or whatever, you know.
You're yeah. being a battle for most prolific songwriter in America
I'm
trying. The Neil Amos. It's awesome, man. Well, Mikey, I got to switch fast with you on one thing, because as you know, and I apologize to you last time I did it. You're always my mystery friend.
I mean, I do know some people.
I've used Mikey like four times for a mystery friend. The last time I was backed in a corner and I was like, fuck, I got to hit up Mikey again. Like, he's the only one who would know. And I did it again.
Was the last one Gethard? Was that the one that
it was?
Okay, yeah, and that was the one that I was on. I was getting on a plane and I didn't get the text.
You blew it.
I blew it. Blew it hard.
Blew it. So,
but I blew it. I also blew it with Brian because I thought that was a funny story. He didn't even remember it. So,
oh. So I went pretty deep since I've always used you as a mystery friend. I went ahead and got a couple mystery friends. Okay.
I'm looking forward to this.
This is fun. There's some good stuff. So let's start slow. Okay. Now, what is the story with the quote, won't be needing this anymore?
Okay. I was in a band called The Dopamines.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite combos I've ever played in, because it was just nothing but fun. There was no bullshit at all in that band. It was just like, let's just have some beers and have a good time.
Okay.
So we play, we did a little tour of the East Coast. We played Best Friends Day, which, if you don't know what Best Friends Day is, it was this festival that Tony from Municipal Waste put on in Richmond, Virginia for about 10 years.
Huh.
And most of it was all around venues in Richmond, and it all culminated in, like, the last day was this gigantic show at they called it Haddad's Lake. It was just a gigantic, like, lake with, like, a rope swing. And
oh, fuck yeah.
And then, yeah, so everybody just, every band that played those days were just in swimming attire, and just, they would, like, be in the lake until they had to play, and then they just put their guitar on, and it was fucking awesome.
That's so Municipal Waste.
Yeah,
so right.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And, like, yeah. You know, it'd be these crazy lineups of, like, you know, Big Freedia and Negative Approach and Against Me and The Dopamines. And, you know, like, it was like super eclectic lineups. It was awesome. Dopamines played with the lineup was Dopamines, 7 Seconds, Against Me.
Wow.
It was an incredible show.
Yeah.
I, you know, as with most Dopamine shows, you had to indulge in a little bit of beer drinking and whiskey drinking before you got on stage.
Okay. A little lube up.
After the set, we were loading the gear into the van, and I took the worst part about this is that this was all in this milk and cheese lunchbox, the comic book milk and cheese. That was one of my favorite things. But yeah, that had my tuner and my guitar cables and power cable and all this stuff in this milk and cheese box. And I threw it into the lake.
Oh no.
And said, I won't be needing this anymore. Cause it was the end of the tour, you know, not thinking till like, you know, next weekend when we had another show that I had to use the gear for. So that was
right. Could really use but, that you know, box,
but I wasn't really thinking in my right mind. So,
yeah. So you sent it to the bottom of to Davy Jones' locker.
Yeah. I definitely like kind of wrote, I think I wrote Tony like the next day. I was like, if anything pops up in that league, I really just want that milk and cheese lunchbox. That's really all I care about. I can buy a new tuner, but
like this municipal waste have a dredge.
Yeah.
A
dredger, right. Like. I mean, I don't know if you wanted to get anything out of that lake after a best friend's day happened either. Cause it
could
was
imagine.
Filthy.
Were you ever able to replace the box?
No, I still can't find one.
All right. So for anyone listening, going off track audience, all hands on deck.
Yeah, I mean, I'll fully admit I was being an idiot, but I would like a milk and cheese lunchbox if anybody knows.
10 years ago. You deserve another one now.
Yeah, I mean,
by now? Oh, that's fucking funny. It was funny, too. I told the person who wrote this because they wrote, in quotes, won't be needing this in capital letters anymore. And I was like, for some reason, I just imagined Mikey saying it like Tina Turner.
Yeah.
Like, I won't be needing this anymore.
That's,
like,
and on the this is when I threw it into the river. And that's, it was, I mean, it's exactly how you picture it.
So perfect enunciation. I love it. All right. Well, I don't think you're going to be able to guess that one. So I'm going to double up here.
Yeah. I mean, I want to, because I've told that story a bunch of times.
Okay. Now, the same person mentioned to me, and this is also in quotes, I think his dad recorded Bon Jovi.
Yes.
And he was around for it. I could be making that up, but his dad definitely worked with some rad folks.
Yep.
To which I replied, can Mikey get any more Jersey?
can I get
so what's the story there?
Can I get any more Sarahville?
Yes. Beyond that.
Literally, Bon Jovi, we're about to make their third album.
Okay.
A little album called Slippery When Wet.
Heard of it.
And I guess I don't know how they came to work with my dad, but I guess my dad was a very, I would assume, cheap back then little basement studio in Sayreville, New Jersey. So
okay,
they locked out. I want to say they were there for at least like 6 or 7 months, like writing the record and demoing it.
Okay,
at my dad's studio. I was there for a lot of it. I didn't know who Bon Jovi was, like. Because
late 80s.
This
is
86, and they had the first two records out. Runaway was a hit, but I didn't know it.
Sure, you were quite young.
Yeah, and so like I just knew that there were these cool rocker dudes at the studio, and there was there you know Tico's drum set was there, and I swear if it might have been 30 pieces, like it it was the biggest drum set I've ever seen in my life.
Rotos, definitely Rotos.
A lot of Rotos. Wow. A lot of Raxwell. I remember because he would let me play it. And I remember like doing tom rolls on like over across like 8 toms or something. Like it was insane. And of course, double bass pedal. Or of course, double bass, 2 drums.
Yeah. I don't remember Tico using all those toms.
I know. It's like when you listen to the record, it's just like, kick snare,
yeah.
But he had a huge drum set. I think there was a gong too.
Yeah, probably
he had the
a
whole
rack
thing.
Yeah, had to be a rack, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. It was the first time I'd ever seen like a rack set up. Yeah. and it was cool. And like every once in a while, like I could take the tapes and like when they weren't there, and like my dad would let me do like my own mixes of the demos. Whoa. And stuff like that. I don't know where any of the shit is anymore. At some point, I think they just took everything.
Right.
Because we used to literally have this 16-track masters of these demo tapes.
Wow. What
and
fun.
And from what I remember them pretty vividly, like a couple, I remember there being one for the song Never Say Goodbye that like he had a sore throat or something at the time. So like he was just trying to sing just to get the melody on tape. But he didn't have a voice. And I remember the like hoarse version of Never Say Goodbye that I've only heard a few times, but I know that it exists somewhere. Like it's just, it's in my brain. And like, you'd think that that album was so gigantic, there'd be like the box set with all of that shit on it. But like, I don't know where that box set is because it hasn't seen the light of day.
So your dad is your family just still sitting on these masters?
No, so that's the thing. I don't know where they went. They were there. I used to drag them at least even into like the, like, you know, 88, 89. I would drag them out and like play them.
Right.
And then at a certain point they just weren't there anymore. And I don't know what happened to them. I guess they must have taken them.
Seized by the Illuminati.
Seized
by the major label is what happened.
Probably, yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah, I guess you did.
Precisely.
They got some Jersey characters to come to the studio and pick them up.
Hey, we're going to need those tapes.
we hear your 8-year-old son's been playing around with them.
You know, the bay is close, okay?
You know that bridge right by the Amboy Cinema?
Yeah.
Going to throw you right off.
Wait, what's that bridge called?
Is that the, what is that?
Not the Marconi. The Marconi is up by Lowe's.
Yeah, what is that bridge called?
Oh, it's killing me.
I want to say it's the Raritan Bay Bridge, but that just seems too easy.
I think it's got a name of an old Italian guy. We'll figure it out. So what was the deal? How long did your father have this studio for?
He had it before. I think it was the mid-70s when he opened it. It was definitely before I was born. And around 2007, 2008 is when like it really just like dried up. No one was, that was, you know, at the point where kind of people were starting to figure out how to do stuff on their own.
Right.
You know, studio kind of stuff was drying up a bit. So he just sold it and moved to Florida, or sold the building and moved to Florida.
Ah, so if he had it all that time, did you record with him?
Yeah, well, like all the early like Ergs demos and stuff, like I did myself at the studio.
What was the name of the studio?
Century Productions.
Nice.
Very
70s.
Yeah, perfect. And he towards the end, actually, most of the time that I was around, when the studio was around. He used to work for this company called San Juan that like licensed music. Like they would buy they'd buy masters of like, we had some pretty cool shit. We had like early Santana stuff before they were signed to Columbia. Like all the like weird early Santana stuff and like weird early Bob Marley stuff from before like the Island Records tenure, like we would have those masters. And then like, so basically back in the day you used to be able to go to like Kmart or you know, just like big box stores and they'd have these CDs that you'd buy for like $4.
Okay.
And they would say that they were, you know, re-recordings, not the original mass, and they were like usually pretty bad re-recordings of, you know, old, you know, I don't know, Motown stuff. And
okay,
but they would just get like, they would get the Miracles, like three guys who used to be in the Miracles but a different lead singer, and that they would re-record all the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles stuff. Like my dad's studio recorded like most of that stuff.
Wow.
Like a lot of, so like we had, you know, like Joey D and like the Crests and Teddy Pendergrass like coming in and recording their old shit.
Yeah.
And so that kind of shit was pretty cool because you were actually meeting like a couple of legends.
Sure.
So we would do a lot of that. I played drums on like a couple of those things.
Really?
Yeah. I think we did a version of like what Kids Bop is, like where we had kids singing like hits of the day or kids singing the Kinks. And so like I played drums on like the Kinks session.
Wow.
Like just stupid shit like that. But like, it was a cool fucking place to grow up.
Yeah. You're literally like born into it.
Yeah. Love. And then like, and for most of my like teenage years, I lived in the house that was attached to it. So like, right. you know, like 4 a.m, I'd go down and I'd just like fucking turn the guitar. It was soundproofed. I'd turn the guitar up, turn the drive, just like jam all night. Wow. And that's like how I wrote a lot of like early Erg songs and stuff like that, was just having a space to do it. It was cool.
I hadn't realized that it was like so ingrained into your early life. Like
yeah.
That.
I mean, like
had you even considered doing anything else?
No. No, I've never considered doing anything else but music. And I actually like always was super interested in being on the production side of it. But then I just kind of started playing it and then didn't really have the time to devote to like, you know, really learning how to record it. Or, you know, going to school for like recording or anything. Like I never got around to doing that, which I'm kind of thinking about maybe trying to do now. Like,
oh, really?
Like now that I'm, you know, it's like, it'd be cool
You're
to
trying
just,
to check off your dream box.
Exactly.
Right?
So, it's like, oh, maybe I can be like a, you know, I'd like to, my dream job would be like archiving for something like for like a record label or like a, you know, old radio shows or
that
something.
That shit is cool. That
like
shit
that.
Is cool.
Cause I'm super into like listening to all that stuff and I love researching things and, you know, finding out like, they recorded this and then 3 days later they recorded this show.
Right.
And, you know, like,
right.
That's like stuff that always fascinates me. So that's definitely like the dream gig. And
it's really cool when you're remastering, how you can like open up a song you already knew and like isolate one tiny part of it and really hear it.
Well, and that's my favorite thing about like, you know, the culture of like, you know, all these albums are getting reissued a million different times with a million different remasterings. And like, I just love hearing all of them and, oh, they really brought out the guitar in this remaster. And like, that's something that I'm super into. So like mastering would be another like gig that I'd really like to really start focusing on.
Yeah. One of my biggest jealousy moments that I ever had in music was when Gaslight was recording American Slang. We got to do it at, oh my God, why am I blanking right now? That's crazy that I am. Magic Shop. It's Magic Shop. Jesus Christ. So we recorded the record there and, you know, in the basement was the one engineer who smoked a ton of weed.
Yeah. your friend.
Yeah. So it's where, you know, we spent a few minutes down there and, you know, one day we're about to take a round and head down and I walk by the studio and who's in there but Ian MacKay.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, okay. I'm like, well, no smoking today.
right. Yeah.
Even the engineer was like on his best behavior. That
I've been straight edge for life, Ian. I swear.
Yeah. Like you want a toke? and I literally like, I walked by the studio like 6 times that day, just waiting to like, kind of have an excuse to like say what's up.
You know,
that was a very strange moment for me. I decided to just like pull the Band-Aid. I walked in and just like you did with Steve Albini, just like, let's get Nirvana out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just did the same thing. I was like, may I just place my nose up your asshole for the next 45 seconds, tell you what probably 1,000 other people have told you about,
exactly,
you know, how your career made their career, blah, 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 cliche. And then maybe we could be cool. But he was literally in the studio with every old Discord reel to reel.
So he was like, because I think towards the end, Magic Shop got into doing like,
yes,
because and now that's what they are, just like an archiving
right
like situation.
Yeah, it seemed like they were starting to lean that way maybe at that time, and man, like him opening up some of that stuff.
This is the shit that I'm like crazy about. Like when you walked in, was he like holding, you know, a fucking, you know, Minor Threat tape or whatever, you know?
Oh, like, yeah, it was Minor Threat. It was Scream. It was like,
awesome.
Dude, every like, it was the really early stuff because it was all the stuff that was on the proper reel to reels,
right.
You know?
I
don't know if he was remastering. I think they were just there to digitize.
I'm sure they were probably just, because that's his other big, just from hearing interviews and stuff with him, like his big thing is like, I just want to make sure everything's archived.
Yeah. Yeah,
so that no one else has to deal with it.
Yeah, it seemed what he was doing. But I remember later that week, they had brought in some old soul stuff. And I think one of them was a James Brown live recording.
That's awesome.
And I mean, fucking isolating these guys on that stage was like one of the coolest fucking things I've ever heard in a studio.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It's so impressive.
No, that stuff just fascinates the hell out of me. So, like, that's actually the coolest thing about the, you know, like, Rock Band and stuff being a thing is that, like, all these master tapes have kind of leaked because the Rock Band game is essentially you just listening to the master tapes. So, like, some wonderful genius figured out how to, like, hack the fucking game and just get them into individual tracks.
Explain this to me. Why is Rock Band that?
Because, like, when you're playing Rock Band, you're playing over the actual basic tracks of the of the actual song, and somehow I don't know why, but because of that, these individual tracks of all these records are out there, quote unquote,
right,
on the internet. Because someone figured out a way to get it all off of the game. So, like, there's literally, like, there's a folder of, you know, pretty much every Beatles record. And,
right,
like, and the individual, like, four tracks of, you know, so you're only hearing Paul's bass and the backing vocal on one track or whatever.
Wow.
You know, it's like, it's crazy. And so I sit for hours and just listen to this shit.
Do you just jam out to Rock Band without the fake guitar?
No, I just listen to it. I just, like, yeah, you just listen to, like, the drum track of these albums that I know by heart anyway, and now I'm just getting to hear the drum track or whatever.
So crazy.
Yeah,
Knowing you makes a lot more sense now. You know, because, I mean, you're just like a walking equivalent of music to me. Like, that's just what always done.
And, it's the only thing that's ever interested me.
Yeah.
And now I'm right. And now it sucks because I'm super into podcasts and films now. So now I have, like, these other two things that are fighting for my time.
Ugh.
And now I feel like I can't
Why'd
devote
you do
any
that?
Time. I know, it's stupid.
Jeez. Just
Why do I waste my time listening to Going Off Track?
Boo.
No, you should listen to it. Just don't make your own podcast. Nobody else should be
That's
doing
literally,
podcasts.
I kept having ideas. I was like, No one needs another fucking podcast.
No. I literally have to, like, when I text certain people or something for an interview now, I'm like, listen, I know everyone, their mother has a fucking podcast. You've probably been asked to do this, like, 19 times in the last month. But you want to come through mine?
I know.
You know,
if they're Jesus done well, Christ. I'm a junkie for them. I love it. It's
I love
a nice interview podcast. It's always fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Hopefully when people start touring again. You know?
Yeah. Well, that was the, like, when I was thinking about doing one, it's like, I'm always traveling and I'm always hanging out with, you know, we'll play with Dillinger Four one night and play with blah, blah, blah the other night. I wanted to interview them about their classic record or whatever. And,
well, so how about, like, you could be not paid as going off tracks, like, man on the scene. You're like our Jordan Clapper or something.
I would do that. There we go. I'll be
you get out there.
We could do special edition podcasts of
hosting
some shit.
Brad, you're going to have to cut Mikey into the fortune, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Big cut.
I definitely need.
So,
I need at least $5.
It's all right.
I need at least a beer the next time we hang out.
We'll negotiate. So, all right. So, can you guess who told me won't be needing this anymore and the dad Bon Jovi?
Bon Jovi. Fuck that. I mean,
I'll give you the two other hints. Okay. We're not going to get into it because we have too many mystery friends.
Right. But right.
The same person said seeing XTC in a different country on a day off from tour.
Yeah.
And also ask him about mastering wax built castles at Abbey Road.
Was it Lauren?
It was Lauren.
Okay, yeah. Because Lauren was there for all four of those things, I think.
Okay. So. Yeah, there you go. by issue of
that's funny, yes.
All right, let's move on to the next because this is fucking funny.
Oh, God.
So this mystery friend say, tell him you heard a rumor.
Oh, no.
That despite all of his New Jersey cred, his favorite diner is actually the Stardust Diner in Manhattan.
That's Chris Gethard.
It is Chris Kattan. Do you want to tell the story? Because that's fucking funny.
I do want to tell the story. Yeah. My favorite diner is the Peter Pank diner, for Christ's sake. Oh, I mean, come
classic.
On now.
Classic. Classic.
May it rest in peace. And I can't believe I didn't get there before it closed.
When did the Pank go down?
Went down a couple years ago. Like probably 4 or 5 years ago at this point. And I remember going, taking the bus down from New York to meet up with my mom and like for like, you know, Christmas stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
being, and they were closing, I think, like before the new year. I had like a limited time and like a couple of days to go there, and I just didn't, I couldn't fit it in. And, and I was just like, I've let my whole entire state down by not getting some Peter Pank.
It's almost like when it's like better that you don't see like a really sick relative or something and you just remember them in their glory.
Yeah.
You know, I can't imagine the Peter Pank on its last week.
It was probably, they probably weren't cooking great food at that point.
I don't think so.
They're probably just getting rid of like,
yeah,
this has been in the fridge for about 5 years. Let's sell it.
Here's some 12-year-old halibut. Blue special.
So Chris Gethard and I was on the Chris Gethard show at the time, and Chris got asked to do the Howard Stern wrap up show.
Right.
Which,
and you're a fan.
And I'm a gigantic, literally the moment he comes on, I'm listening. I listen live every day. I used to travel when I'd go on tour, I would bring a printout of the, when he was still on terrestrial radio, I'd bring a printout of the affiliates. So I knew what station to listen every morning to Howard Stern.
A real Sternophile.
I'm obsessed. But so I was like, yo, you got to take, or I think he might have even offered, like, I know that this would be the biggest thing in your life if I took right, you right. up to the wrap up show.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, and here's what you can do for me. I haven't listened in a while. Can you just get me up to speed on who like the new Whack Packers are? So I like,
sure.
He's like, I just don't want to sound like I haven't been listening. So he's like, let's go to this Stardust Diner. That sounds good. Well, that's right. That's right next to, know, where they do the show. Like this would be cool.
And that's, he said, Sirius then? You're in Midtown?
Yeah. Yeah. So we were like, you know, right near like Rockefeller Center and all that.
Sure.
Neither of us knew what this diner was. It sounded like
not the hub of New York City food.
Certainly not. We walk in and it just feels like kind of a normal diner for a minute. We order whatever food we get. And then all of a sudden it's like showtime. And there are people dancing on the tables and like, and we were just like, what the fuck? So like, our entire mission of doing this was so that we could talk about the Howard Stern show, and you couldn't talk over any of this stuff. And so we realized later that it's a tourist trap that is kind of, I guess, where everybody who wants to do Broadway, that's
right.
that's where they work and like just try to, you know, hone their skills so that.
So it's like all the understudies work at the Stardust.
And it was just like, and it was one of those things where like every time we actually started to get a conversation going, the song would start playing again and then we'd be interrupted. It was.
And what are we talking here? Like they're just like walking around the aisles, just singing,
yeah, and like
along with these tracks and dancing and stuff.
Yes,
like the whole deal.
And like, I feel like there was dancing on tables involved, and like,
goodness,
yeah, and
it's like half Coyote Ugly.
Chris Gethard and I are just like, what the fuck is going on? What is this?
And I'm
place?
Imagining just you two face to face,
exactly.
So unassuming.
Just like,
yeah.
And like it was funny because we were just, you know, we're fairly close friends, but this was fairly early on in the Gethard show too.
Right,
so I feel like it was like, we were still like, this might've been the first time we like hung out for a long period of time.
Okay.
That wasn't
so
at
still
work.
A touch of awkwardness.
It was
there.
Definitely might've been a little awkward too. Like that kind of added to the like hilarity of the situation.
Sure. Like, I don't know you that well. And we're
yeah. I mean, like it wasn't
together.
Like,
yeah.
it was early on in like the cable run. So we knew each other, but like, we certainly didn't spend like a shitload of time together before this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's hilarious.
We were just like, of course this happens too. And this is so, this is weird. but it was, it's a story that we can tell on podcasts whenever we,
yeah, meet. Fucking funny, man. Yeah. So his exact quote was, "We met before. He's a student, Stern super fan. We met beforehand. I figured we'd meet at a diner and didn't realize the Stardust is a gimmick diner where the wait staff leets onto tables and sings show tunes." So he says at like 7:45 a.m.
That's the
me
thing.
And
it was,
Mikey are trying to
comically,
catch up, and there's literally, yeah.
It was comically early in the morning too. It was like, yeah, we were not, and oh, and we had taped the show the night before.
Oh,
and every night, you know, Gethard would go hang out, but I would go, we would all go to a bar after the taping. And usually that was like our letting our hair down and, you know, having a few drinks. So I was definitely hungover at this point too. And, right. This was not the place I wanted to be hungover at seven in the morning.
No.
Before knowing that I was walking into like my, you know, heaven.
Yeah. And he did mention too, he's like, well, you know what? He's like, I got that motherfucker to meet Baba Booey. So
yeah, no,
fair enough.
It was an amazing day.
It's so fun. I couldn't help but hear that story. And one of my first reactions to it was, fuck, I feel bad for the people who work there.
That we did too. I think that was like, that was the whole thing, which we were like, it's so like knowing what it's like to be fucking busting your ass as like a performing artist. Like, that's not the gig I want to do.
Yeah.
It's
like imagining a person who had to get up at like six.
Cause not only do you have to perform, you have to serve food, which is like also difficult.
You probably got to commute on like a crosstown bus.
Yeah.
You got to get there and like put that shit on. And at 7 a.m, start singing like Les Mis to people. What a fucking nightmare. Yikes.
It's making me, I got to go back. I got to go. Yeah. I gotta go have that. We Gethard and I should commemorate the experience by going again.
Yeah, you should. That is the idea. All right, so that one was great. And here's the last. Okay. So you got Gethard, you got Lauren. This is the last. Said once on New Year's Eve, The Measure played a show in Gainesville. After we went to a party at the guy from Les and Jake's house, we weren't sure if it was cool that we showed up. As we walk in, an Erg song is blaring. People saw Mikey enter, picked him up, and started crowd surfing him around the party. The guy is a star. I think that's the only PG Mikey story I have.
That's Jay Insult.
Or it's not.
Okay, it's Fid then.
Yeah, it's the Fiddler.
Okay. They were both there that night.
Okay.
And yeah, it was certainly very, because we were like friends of friends of friends. Like, the Ergs had definitely played with Les and Jake. So we did kind of know them a little bit, but like, I wouldn't have called myself friends with Les and Jake at the time.
Right.
I think one of the guys from, we were playing with Grab Ass Charlestons, and they were like, okay. Oh yeah, that like the party in town is Roger from Les and Jake's New Year's Eve party, and we were in Gainesville on New Year's Eve. So that, yes, we walked in and they were playing Dork Rock Cork Rod, and it was the most surreal moment of my life.
So right before you walked in the door, was it one of those like, oh my God, like, I don't even know if I'm like welcome at this.
No,
party.
We literally, like, we'll see how this goes. We might be looking for a hotel in about 2 minutes because we don't know what else to do in this town tonight. But we'll,
and you just open the door and we're immediately getting crowd surfed around.
Yeah.
How did the night pan out then?
I mean, it panned out great. it was just a party. I honestly don't remember. I don't think we stayed there. We probably stayed with someone a mutual friend that was also at the party. But I mean, we hung out all night and danced and had and drank and had a wonderful, wonderful evening, wonderful New Year's.
Funny, man.
But it certainly was like walking up to it. We were like, this could go really poorly or really well. And it went
really Gainesville well. Can be intimidating like that, right?
Yeah. And like we kind of just through Fest and through like, you know, going through there pretty much. Like whenever you do a tour, if you do Florida at all, you at least do Gainesville because you don't have to go too far down
to get
there.
Only like an hour south of Georgia.
It's like, you know, I can count the times I've played Miami on one hand in my entire 20 years of touring.
Same.
But but I've been to Gainesville, you know, 100 times. So like between that and Fest, I felt like we knew we were friendly with people, and we knew enough people where, like, you know, we got to know someone at this party, but we
Gainesville adjacent.
Yeah. But we, you know, there was also, we also knew it was one of the people from Less Than Jake throwing the party. So we were like, who's going to be at this fucking thing? Like this.
Yeah. Right. Right. Like the guy from Fishbone going to be there?
Right. I mean, are we going to, is the Capitol label guy going to be there? Like,
right. Yeah.
Am I going to get signed tonight?
They're big fucking bad. That's fucking funny, man.
No, it was great, but I was certainly was not expecting to hear my singing voice coming out of the speakers when I walked up to the house.
So funny, man. Well, and then Fid also shared, I couldn't use this as a mystery friend because it would have been too obvious. He said he recorded 31 Hat Rabbit songs in a day once. He also recorded 60 songs in two sessions, hearing them all for the first time on the spot for the new shit, and then recorded the new dress cover the next day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did, like, I actually, like, functionally want to ask you, like, when you're presented with 30 songs like that,
yeah,
you know, stuff that you, like, didn't know, what's your method for internalizing that? Are you all ear? Do you take notes?
I am all ear. I used to, like, you know, there were a couple, and I don't think Fid would disagree that his songs are particularly kind of difficult, just because he writes in a way that the only other way, because like I was saying before, is like I'm very, you know, kind of simple, 60s rock and pop punk influenced, where the songs don't have that many parts. But like Fid, and the only time I ever had to use notes for the first couple of times on stage was Ensign.
Oh, right.
Which is because I just...
Been there, bro.
Yeah, right. But I just don't, it doesn't make sense in my brain.
The
verse goes for two this time. Then you do the sub...
Big Tom part.
Yeah, the sub breakdown with the toms. Yeah, right. Yeah. And then you go back into a four verse,
back to the two step,
and then you have the hardcore breakdown, which is different than the hardcore breakdown in the last song. So it's stuff like that I needed, like, my notes of, like, oh yeah, this is like the half chugga chugga part or whatever.
Yeah. I would love to compare your Ensign notes with mine, just out of curiosity, because I have the same shit.
Once I got it though, that was the most fun I've had playing drums during a set. Just playing cool shit. And playing. They're fun songs to play once you actually wrap your head around them.
Sure. They are.
So that was cool. But yeah, and that's so awesome. with the Hat Rabbits records, it's like, it's just kind of, you know, we kind of have this rhythm going that we actually used to have in the measure where we would just, we'll just like learn the song, get it down once, and then tape it. And so it's essentially what I feel like what most people would do, like, oh, this was the practice demo.
Right.
And then we'll refine it later. But like, so like the practice demo ends up being our like first take on the record, which is like, why bother doing it again? I'm not going to play it any different, really.
Sure.
You know,
well, I wonder if using that like initial impulse that you have in songwriting and not touching it again actually helps in remembering it.
It probably does. And
because it's so internal, right?
Yeah. And I've done it both ways, where like you work on something for 6 months and then you come up with, like, you know, or like, you know, the Ergs would do this all the time, where we would record something and then we'd play it live for 6 months, and then I'd be doing completely different shit on the drums.
Yes, right.
Because you play it a million times. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's what should have been played on the record either, you know?
No, totally not. I think that's the beauty of live music.
Like, that's the funny thing about, you know, having listened to and read a lot, read so much about music that I've, as I have, and like realizing, oh, you know, Fleetwood Mac took 8 months to make a record or whatever, you know, like, I wonder how much of that was just completely wasted time that just didn't need to be.
Probably like, tons.
You know, and like I'm very much of a, like a first, the first take is usually your most like, energetic. And, you know, once you, like, I feel like if I'm doing 10, 15 takes, I'm like kind of dumbing the drum part down just so I can get it done. Like, if,
yeah, you know, right.
Like, I feel like I'd rather just get the like really energetic first take out of the way.
Sure. Yeah, there is some with drum takes like that, isn't there? Like, I have found now through the years that if I'm not getting it, you know, for whatever reason, like by take four, take five, I know it's not going to get any better than that.
Right.
In the moment, you know, like in the moment, like, and you either have to rewrite something or revisit it, but like pounding the pavement doesn't really.
Yeah.
Seem to
it's,
work.
I mean, especially with like a drum track, I feel like it's, well, it, we might as well just come back to this tomorrow because I'm burnt out on it. And,
right.
And yeah. I don't even want to play this fucking thing anymore.
Exactly.
So like,
yeah.
Yeah. So I normally try to get first or second takes, and it's like, it's pretty easy. And like also with Fid stuff, he's a really good person to work with. If I'm not coming up with something, Fid knows exactly what he wants to sound like. And I've played, obviously we just talked about two records where one of them was 30 songs. One of them was 60 songs.
Right.
Like, I've played enough of his songs to know, to pretty much have instinct of what he's going to want.
Sure.
So it's actually fairly easy for me to do those records, even though it sounds like an insane amount of work.
But a lot of it's just years. Like, you just know where Fid's coming from at this point.
And that's the thing, you know, that's the cool thing about, like, if you've worked with a songwriter for enough that you know how, you just know how they write songs. And so you know where they're going to go. Even if it's not the same song you heard last week, it's like, you kind of know how they write and that they're going to go to the bridge here or whatever, or, you know, or in a hardcore sense, it's like, okay, this is where the two steps part's going to happen.
Right.
You know, or whatever, you know?
Yeah. There's only one place in a hardcore song the two steps should be. It's like, come on, let's not rewrite the wheel here. Age of Quarrel was great.
I know.
So let's just keep it going.
Yeah. I can't wait for that Age of Quarrel reissue on Record Store Day.
Yeah. You know, it's coming. Maybe you'll get to remaster it.
Yeah, maybe.
So, that's awesome. Well, shout out, please, to Lauren and Chris and Fid for providing us with. Is this? Did I make up for it, Mikey?
Yes.
That's
fun. I love it. It's one of my favorite segments on this wonderful show that you have, and it's amazing to be in the hot seat for this one.
The driver's seat. Yeah, the driver's seat. I was like, I can't just get one for Mikey. I used it up. I used my card up too much. But now you owe me like six mysteries.
All right. I'll make sure that I mean, that's the problem. It's like what Fid said is like, what do I have PG for all these people?
Yeah, I know where a lot of your and Fid's stories go for sure. I know those firsthand. That's awesome. Well, I got to talk to you about the Descendants real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a discussion ensued with Joshy, actually, from School Drugs the other day, where we're talking about the Descendants and them being, I mean, just amazing.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing that came up was how singularly unique they are and how kind of no one has really come close to grabbing like the Descendants torch, even like when they weren't around.
Right.
Like, there's no one you can just say like, oh, that's like the Descendants, you know? And, you know, we're talking and we're like, who came close? And I'm like, the Ergs? And I'm like, that's the closest I can come up with, because it's like the only one I can think of that's like musically in line, where the members of the Ergs were fantastic players. You wrote great catchy songs, but then the other caveat that no one seems to do is have a fucking sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
And present it in that kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek sort of way, like Descendants did it. And I asked Josh, you straight up, I'm like, am I just saying the Ergs because I'm from New Jersey and this is like confirmation bias? And he's like, no, I think it is too. So you seem to have come the closest of anyone. Like, what do you think makes them so special and hard to recreate?
Well, I do think, I mean, I guess, so I was always fairly confused at why we would get the comparison.
Really?
Although, I mean, you know, I was like, okay, well, lead singer with glasses.
Oh, right.
And we all, and we all kind of know how to play our instruments.
Right.
I mean, especially Joe and Jeff are, you know,
yeah,
as masterful at bass and guitar as Stefan and Carl.
Sure.
But I always thought that like the comparison really was because we played fast and played well. As I say with a smirk on my face.
I think it's fair to say. It's
but okay. But yeah, but I mean that there's no question that was certainly the like if you pull that was probably our biggest influence as a band, just in terms of, you know, just making sure we sounded good, like trying to write good songs and I don't know, like doing it the way, you know, you tour for a year and make sure you get tight or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I guess, yeah, because they, the sentence are so weird to me too, because they're, especially their early albums, that's my favorite thing about like that 80s SST thing is you could misconstrue those records for like wildly inconsistent. Especially like a record like Enjoy, which contains all of my favorite Descendants songs, but it also contains 10 minutes of farting.
Right. Yes.
And I feel like even like New Day Rising by Husker Du is like, it's got like these really great songs and it's got these like weird dirges and like, love that's what people are like, and like the Replacements were putting out these records that were like, you know, Gary's Got a Boner, but then 16 Blue. It's like, just love that. Like that was like okay back then to to not just overthink that. I mean, that kind of goes back to like, why bother overthinking something in the studio? If like you want to put Orgo Fart on a record because you think it's funny, just put it at the end where people can skip it if they want. Like, I don't know. Like, and I think maybe I never thought of it this way until just now, but maybe because we would put that shit on, you know, we would put Maybe I'm the New Messiah on a record, even though like, I know it's not the most brilliant fucking song that's ever been written because it's kind of funny. Like,
I mean, it's just not taking yourself too seriously in that way. Right.
But then, you know, the other songs taking ourselves seriously. We were doing it in the right way. It was funny. One of my favorite stories that, I feel like maybe Sue would have been there. Maybe Sue could have given it as a Mystery Friend story. Oh, but I went and saw Flag or War and Women open for Flag.
Okay.
And Sue got me into the show and got me backstage and I was hanging out. And I've known Stefan already. We had worked together a few times. And so he introduced me to Bill for the first time.
Okay.
And he was like, Bill, this is Mike Yerg. He's, you know, obviously from the Yergs. And then Bill says, oh, that band that everybody says sounds like us.
Oh, no.
And I was like, yeah. He's like, I don't understand it, man. We're both just trying to be the Buzzcocks.
Oh.
I was like, awesome. Cool.
And then that's so freeing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was so freeing. And then we just passed around literally a scotch bottle all night and talked about Ornette Coleman for like 4 hours. And it was like one of the greatest nights of my life.
Why does every Bill Stevenson story I hear just add to this narrative that just really makes me love him more and more?
He really is. I mean,
like, what a unicorn.
The like few hours I've spent with him have been absolute wonderful experiences where he doesn't mind talking about, I mean, that we spent a couple hours at a Mexican restaurant once talking about like him joining Black Flag and how he was already kind of the on-call like guy who would fill in whenever Robo couldn't do it. And then it just made sense for him to join. I was like, I never knew that. That's crazy. Like,
yeah,
like, right. I was always just there. I was always just at the practice anyway. So I just play like, it's like all these really cool stories. And he's got a million stories because he's been everywhere.
Yeah. And it's like he has so many that they're still not even all on like wax.
Right. No, yeah. It's very, he's a very cool person to talk to. He's super down to earth, super, you know, he's rad. And it was, and that was like a total disarming of like, I was like on guard. Cause I was like, oh, of course he thinks that we just rip them off. He's like, no, we're just ripping off the Buscocks, man.
Yeah. This has the greatest vibe. Yeah. About
and
it.
I was just like, yes, that's it. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Thank God. That's awesome. So in your estimation, then, you know, has there been anybody to you that's kind of come close to holding that like Descendants candle, especially when they weren't around?
Oh yeah. I don't think so. Not really, right? Yeah. I don't think there's anybody that really, really came close to just having that like perfect pop sensibility, but also having the hardcore thing like that, you know. I don't know. That was the other thing that we always wanted to be was like, yeah, we want to do 15-second hardcore songs and then also do these like 2-minute pop punk songs, you know, like.
Right.
And that was definitely something that I don't even think of it as us taking it from them, but that we also were taking from both Minor Threat and Green Day, you know, like,
yeah,
and then putting that all together. And then it just ended up sounding like the Descendants.
Yeah.
Even totally. Though. But I don't know, like, yeah, you know, there are the bands that, you know, that like covered that, you know, like, or like, you know, I don't know, Face to Face, like took, they know that they really were influenced by the Descendants, but I still don't think any of that stuff sounds like the Descendants.
No, especially the vibe. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's really is the vibe that, you know, and I never even really thought about that before, but I do think the main comparison between us and them would be like the vibe of like, fuck it.
Right. Yeah.
Let's put a jazz part on this because we want to play jazz right now. Like,
well, that's always what's bizarre to me is that, you know, I was never a huge West Coast punk fan.
Yeah.
You know, so pop punk to me when I was a kid was like no effects.
Right.
And yeah. I was like, oh, fuck that shit. Like, I just wasn't into it because it was too silly, you know, like, and it didn't mean anything to me. And I was just like, I don't know. I'm from here. I'm from New Jersey. Shit sucks. Like, I need like real music, you know?
Yeah.
And then I really connected with the Descendants and I can't for the life of me see what those two bands have anything to do with each other.
Right.
But they're just still in that genre. And it's kind of bizarre. I feel like Descendants need their own, you know?
Were you an AOD guy?
A little. I dabbled.
Like, that was the band for me, and I think even like Joe too, where we just like we were instantly proud to be from New Jersey once we heard that band.
Right.
And they were another band that like they were talking about, sometimes they were talking about serious subjects, but then they'd, you know, write a song about bugs taking over the world or whatever. You know, like they obviously had a sense of humor, but they were definitely writing songs that were kind of meaningful too.
Yeah.
But they were also just fucking kick ass and
sure.
Just like this band rules. We want to be like AOD as well.
Yeah. And their name was still like kind of kicking around so much when we were kids.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Like, well,
it was still present.
The first time I heard the letters AOD was at the 96 Warp Tour watching NoFX. And they were like, the only good thing to ever come out of New Jersey is AOD.
Oh, shit.
And then we had to figure out what AOD was, and then
wow. Well, I came full circle.
Yeah, there it is.
That's awesome, man. Mikey, I've had you on forever already, so I just want to ask one more question I needed to know from you, since you're becoming such a prolific songwriter at this point. And, you know, I want to know, like, how do you want people to walk away from your music? Like, what do you want people to feel like or take from it? Is there any objective when you're writing songs in that way?
I don't know. I write pop songs. So it's like, I want you know, I write about my like certain experiences. I feel like a lot of times they're pretty veiled and or you know, just something that only I really know or care about.
Right.
So I just try to make it as like catchy as I can, and then hopefully people will gravitate towards it because of that.
Right.
But you know, I don't know. I just enjoy writing. So
you're not like, this is going to make people happy or this is going to make people feel something. It's just about enjoying the music.
Yeah. I never really think of it that way. Like it has, I mean, certainly people have come up to me and said that like Erg songs have gotten them through, you know, tough breakups or, you know, whatever. And like, that's the most amazing feeling you can ever have is
sure.
Someone telling you that like, oh, I got through a real bad night because I put your record on, you know, that,
sure.
that there's nothing as a musician, you can't hear anything other than, you know, that's the best thing you can hear. So, you know, I wasn't thinking of that person when I wrote that particular song or whatever. So like, you know, it's hard to say like, oh yeah, no, I'm trying to get this thing out there. But like, I just enjoy writing songs and I, you know, it feels really good when people get it, you know?
Right.
And so awesome, I just like to keep writing songs and hope that people will dig them.
Well, I think they will. I mean, I got a chance, you know, like, I don't know if anyone else complains about this to you, but sometimes when I start to scratch the surface, I'm like, wait, where the fuck should I start again with Mikey? You know, cause there's so much stuff.
Yeah.
But really like, I dug into the solo stuff a lot when we were, you know, getting ready for this.
Yeah.
Really fucking good, man. And I think it's getting better and better and it's improving
in a lot of
different ways. And
I think I know more about songwriting or I'm a better songwriter. I'm really proud of all the solo records and I like the way I'm going about it where it's like, it's all kind of different. Like, I'm not just going to throw the same album out again after, you know, one after another. Like just to keep it interesting for me. And those are the kind of, you know, one of my favorite bands is like the Meat Puppets, where literally every single album sounds completely different than the last one.
Right.
Like, you know, it's that shit is cool to me. Or like Frank Zappa, where it's like every record, no two Frank Zappa records sound the same.
Sure.
Like, and that's, you know, while I'm not taking it to that extreme
right.
but,
not yet
but
not
I do
yet.
Like the idea of like, okay, what's it gonna sound like if I record it in a rehearsal space but then take it to Abbey Road to master it? What's that gonna sound like?
yeah.
Like, what's it gonna sound like if me and Pierce and Fid do a record in 4 hours but then Stefan Edgerton mixes it and makes it sound like the Descendants? Like, what's that gonna sound like? You know, that's, it's all a big fun experiment that I hope people are along for the ride for.
I love it. Stay curious, man.
Yes.
I love it. Didn't even get to ask Mikey what his favorite grease truck sandwich is.
Oh, how'd that happen?
We didn't even get it. We barely touched New Brunswick. We got into so much fun stuff.
I think over the past like 6 to 8 weeks, there's been a lot of New Jersey talk in this podcast.
I wonder why. You didn't know. You started a podcast with one of the 12 disciples.
The champions of New Jersey.
That's what I'm saying.
Champions of New Jersey. There's your band. There's your all-star band. Champions of New Jersey.
For us who never leave, when people never leave New Jersey, this place starts to get real small, real quick, you know? And that's the case. Both Mikey and I are 40 years in. And not only 40 years in, we're straight Central Jersey characters.
Right.
So we're from the place that North and South Jersey doesn't think exists, you know, which kind of gives you this like even more Jersey bravado, you know, because a normal Jersey person, you're hated by all of America, essentially, especially like New York and Connecticut and Pennsylvania. But when you're from Central Jersey, you get the added bonus of North and South Jersey hating you, too. So it really is the singular experience.
Are you native Jersey Americans? Is that what you would call yourself?
I think so.
Nice.
I think that's fair. Yeah. Right. Now let me ask you this, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you've been so Jersey adjacent for the last couple months and talking to all these characters, you listen to me fucking spout off for like a couple hours a week. What do you think are the consistent themes of a New Jerseyan?
Diners and
tread lightly. Tread lightly.
Diners, Bon Jovi, those two things have come up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And are almost too cliche.
What about more like personality-wise?
Oh, personality-wise?
What are we? What are we like? I can't self-evaluate, you know? You don't want to do this. Listen to him.
There's definitely something there. I have a couple of really close friends that I've known for a long time who are also Jersey, Central Jersey people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely, there's a thing. There's a thing for sure. It's hard to put it into words, I guess, but I could do it when I have more time. Okay. I'll think about it.
Give this one some thought.
I'll think about it.
Yeah. So I can't wait to hear Mikey's new album with Steve Albini.
Oh, yeah.
He's probably going to make like two more albums before we hear that one.
I mean, I really like that last one, the one with the Clash bite cover.
Fucking awesome. It's great.
That's like,
it's great. Really?
That's like right up my alley, that kind of stuff. That's mm-hmm. what I liked to listen to when I was a young buck. And I still do. I still enjoy it. It was great. But
it's great.
Just the delivery, the content, it's like, it's very familiar to me. I like it.
Can't wait. And new record with Albini. I'm sure some touring coming up with Warriors and all the different projects he has. And
An eye out for Mikey. You can follow him at Mikey Erg, just one word on Instagram and Twitter, MikeyErg. Check out the record. Keep an eye out for him. Go see him in any of those bands because they're all great. And
I've noticed, Brad, I've noticed something slow down recently. Can I talk about it?
Please.
You know, I thought, all I was going to have to do is poke the audience once or twice with giving us ratings and reviews, and particularly reviews of a sexually suggestive nature. I thought this would be a lot of fun for people, you know, and I really thought that this was going to be a bigger thing. Not like viral or something, but I thought one day I'm going to look on the podcast feed.
And there's going to be five
sexy reviews, and I crack up laughing. And at some point I meet these people on the road. Like, it's funny for me. So if you're up for it and you enjoyed the program, I'd like you to go online. Maybe after you listen to a Teddy Pendergrass album, maybe the new Silk Sonic.
There you go.
Put something nice on. Put something cozy on. Maybe have a sifter of cognac. Just something to settle the mood down. And write us a review. And if it, you know, happens to get a little R to X rated, it's good for me. So please, my people, you know, let's have some fun here.
All right. That would be wonderful. Right. Thank you. Thanks for listening. We love you. And see you next week.
Love you, everyone. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.